If you're not a master of yourself, there is no way you're going to master the environment around you. And what I mean by that is everything to do with self-mastery, like how you keep yourself in optimum physical condition. Because how you are physically is going to determine how you manage stress.
Meet Frank Cuiulli, a renowned expert in peak performance and flow science who boasts over 20 years of experience in martial arts and high-tech business, backed by a diverse educational background in neurophysics and neuroscience.
If you truly are a person trying to create a diversity in your employment base, that means you've got people that you're employing that think differently and act differently to you. And if you don't understand how your biases show up and how you filter and interpret these people, all you want is yes people. People who are a mini version of you, but not as good, right? And that will say yes to you. And that is not the maker of a great entrepreneur. And so the more you understand you, like how you communicate, how you receive communication, how you lens, how you like bias when you see someone and their behavior and you automatically default to this when actually it's that, you know, and that level of self-awareness and self-mastery, like if you don't have that, man, you're never going to be a great leader. When I see entrepreneurs, I walk into their businesses and I see the diversity of kind of people, then I go, okay. You know, this is a person who really, really understands themselves. And quite often that tends to be true. Not always, but most of the time, right? You can really see that person knows their strengths and weaknesses. And that person has created that diverse culture and has a very different ranging set of people around them, advising them. That's when I see entrepreneurs who really succeed and do well, because they really get that themselves.
What I'd love to speak about is your entrepreneurial journey. And I'd love to, for people who are, late 20s, in that 30 range, you know, what kind of things they can learn from what you've learned in business from a mindset perspective and like, you know, the practices you have and things like that. So I guess a good starting point is, you know, what has your journey been as a businessman, business owner and entrepreneur?
Yeah, so I grew up in a very entrepreneurial family. So my parents, ever since I can have recollection of life, right, I have owned their own business. My mum was in the fashion industry. My dad left his government job to support her and help build the fashion business. It was the family business. I remember from my youngest recollection, mum she was a maker. She was a dressmaker, so she used to work in the fashion district in Surry Hills. She had a factory. I used to spend all my time at the factory or at my grandparents. From there, they got into market stalls, and every weekend, you know, I was at the markets. Everything from my dad, my uncles, my grandfather, they all ran market stalls while the sisters, my mum and her sisters, made the clothes. And that was just normal life. So I've always, I guess, grown up with the fact that you just kind of own businesses, you know? It was just a natural thing. It was a good and a bad thing because I think for me, I didn't really value school, right? I valued learning on the street. And that was very much the theme of my youth. For good and bad, right? And I was very sporty, so I was always training, always competing in martial arts. For me, life was very much about running your own show, you know. Until I really had to force myself to find a career, and then, you know, I think for me, that's when I really had to start learning. I didn't have a business background or degree or even like a fundamental foundation of learning school, you know, high school learning. I was never there. You know, I should never have graduated, right? When I started in my work life, I did so out of necessity. I had to find something to do. I started in the fashion industry because I knew fashion. I went to menswear and worked in the menswear space. And that's actually what opened up the door to my career in tech. I fell into it. It was not by design. I had someone who I sold some suits to who liked how I sold and offered me a job. And I took the job. Failed dismally at the first job because I knew nothing about computers. I knew nothing about PCs. This was the age of PCs when they were just evolving, right? The 386, you know, like business, like PCs were. The whole notion of a home office hadn't even begun, you know, and there was no internet, right? So, I started selling PCs, failed, you know, had to learn about what a computer is, you know, how to do quotes, how to greet customers, like you name it, how to make phone calls and like nothing I'd ever done or ever studied. Failed at that, moved, went to another place, failed at that, you know, went to another place and all of a sudden started to find my feet, right? I was used to failure kind of never bothered me. You know, I'd seen my parents struggle in business and you just kind of get up and you get on with it, right? And so I never really took the knocks as like a soul crushing experience. I just accepted it's just part of, you know, part of the learning process. And certainly with martial arts, you know, you get knocked to the canvas, you get back up, right? And dust yourself off and go again. So that was ingrained for me. And I think I very much I leaned on my sports and my background in training to learn how to learn, right? So I had, because I had to learn fast, I had to learn quick, I had to adapt to a whole new environment I've never been in. So it was only probably after about my third job in tech where I started to really find my feet. You know, I was the kind of guy that I was ambitious, so I bounced around. You know, I'd get to as far as I could get to in a business. If I the minute I started plateauing out, if there was another job on offer, I'd take it. You know, to bump myself up, You know, not what I recommend to people today, but back then you kind of could. And I did that, and did that successfully, and you know, I took a step back on income when I left retail, even though it wasn't a lot of money. I still took a massive step back to get into tech. And then after I found my feet, you know, ended up doubling my income every year for, you know, 5 consecutive years, right? And that was good. You know, got into software, which was really a turning point for me. Actually, that was while I was in the distribution side of technology, and I became a product manager for IBM for their software because they just, this is when IBM just reinvented themselves as a business and decided that they were actually going to sell software. And they created, this is under the Lou Gerstner days, where he created a whole category of e-commerce, right? And you know, back then IBM had an amazing culture and it was really good to be part of that and learn. Even though I was in that channel, I was developed a lot in that IBM channel. And did very well. Had some real hit out of the ballpark moments in those roles. And then really loved software. You know, kind of that's it. I kind of moved away from hardware altogether and just kind of became a software guy. But you know, I struggled with the notion of a boss. You know, like I struggled with. You know, I was always very critical of, you know, why do we do things like this or why do we do things like that, right? And I knew nothing, yeah. But
it was me too.
Easy to be critical, right? And so, you know, kind of worked my way up. And then 10 years into my craft, this was just post September 11, had just done a startup with a Danish software company. And this was the first, this was when CRM really wasn't even. It was a category, but in its very early days. And there was a Lotus Notes ISV who'd built a CRM suite on top of Lotus Notes, which back then Lotus Notes was an advanced platform, you know, very similar to almost what you see in a lot of these agile platforms today, right? But it was way ahead of its time, actually. And I worked with a Dane who'd come over here and we launched the Australian business. And that was my real first taste of what startup culture was like. And I loved it. Like, one, they were a Danish mob and I loved the Danish culture. You know, the CEO was very approachable. He resembled nothing like any of the other CEOs I'd worked for. He was a Viking, you know, in every sense of the manner, Lars. And I loved him, you know, like he was awesome. And I think I learned a lot. he became my model of what good CEOs really look like, you know. And, you know, went through a journey with IT Factory and, you know, they grew aggressively, made some acquisitions, and kind of then this post-September 11 things kind of fell apart a little bit. I decided at that point I wanted to do my own thing, to try my own thing. So I went into my own business. Ignorantly and stupidly, I picked a whole different industry. I went into property development because, you know, Italians, man, like, you know, everyone in my family are builders and concreters and whatever. And I thought, yeah, I can do this development thing. But rather than just pick a subdivision or a small house and redo it, you know, I guess that was the competitive side of me. I said, I'm going to go big. You know, if you're going to go, let's do it all. And picked off a 40 apartment block, you know, like 8-story, 40 apartments is my first development. And got my ass absolutely kicked in that. I lost everything. So that was my first $1 million mistake, cash.
It's funny now, but not then.
No, it wasn't funny at all. And you know, my wife just looked at me one day when we finally just acknowledged, like, we're screwed, you know, and she says, right, let's sell up and start again. And I think that was the most liberating thing that I've ever heard her say. Because I was, to be honest, more worried about, I didn't care for me. Yeah, you know, it's about what hurt, the impact on her. So to hear her say, don't worry, like, you've done it once, you can do it again. Let's go. And so we did. So sold everything up, sold my house. We just bought, you know, we were young, only young, you know, married for 4 years or whatever, you know, bought our house. Had to sell that, did well out of that, luckily. That helped retire a lot of the debt because my family underwrote my debt, right? And I didn't, so there was none of this, I just go bankrupt and start, you know, bullshit. It was my family's, you know, guarantees, right? So I couldn't just go bankrupt. I had to pay every dollar back. And it was $1 million is a lot of cash. But we did, sold up everything. I was still about 250 in the hole, and my parents just, you know, underwrote that and said, okay, get it. And it was interesting because I'd never forget, like, the minute I made the decision, okay, I'm coming back, I'll make it back, it was a different me. And it was a different me because I'd just been through the wars, right? And, like, when you lose hard cash yourself, it hardens you as an entrepreneur. It really does, right? And I went, you know what, sorry, I'm going to swear by, fuck it, like, this is it, you know. So I came back in and it was interesting because it was a different me to who left the industry, right? And interestingly enough, you know, my first job back in was with a company called TIBCO. And my boss at the time, Mark Farmy, who I have the utmost respect for even to this day, you know, he hired me because he said that, he told me after, he said, Frank, I hired you because you had the gumps, you had the balls to go and put your own money on the line and lose it. He goes, you've lost more money than a lot of the people you're going to sell to have made, right? As in their job. He goes, so don't fear anyone. And that stuck with me, right? And that shift in attitude, I can't, you know, if I think about my selling career pre losing everything, I was very much about putting hierarchy on stage, on a pedestal, you know, like looking up to the C-suite, oh, you know, like scared to approach executives, scared to get it wrong. After that, I didn't care. After that, I was like, you know what, man, like, I don't care what you make. I've lost more than that. So, you know, we can talk, you know, and it was interesting because that shift in attitude and the hustle you get, I had the best 3 years I'd ever had. I made more money in those 3 years than I made in 10, you know.
Wow.
And I made back everything I'd lost, you know, paid down all my debts, you know. And so, you know, as a sales guy, you know, I was making more than my bosses, right? That's a great thing about a salesperson. You can do that, you know. And my boss was happy. Like, as mate, if I'm writing you big checks, it means you're making me money. So, and Mark was awesome like that. You know, I learned a lot from him. But then the little voice inside my head that was, you know, always my Achilles heel, want more, want better, You know, I went and then I got recruited into Oracle, their Siebel team, and you know, also the guy who recruited me then, great sales guy, knew how to push my buttons. You know, I walked away from another $1 million paycheck at TIBCO. You know, I can say that openly, and because you know I had a massive pipeline, I could have made bank again, but I walked away on the basis that I wanted to get into the boardroom, and you know, with Oracle I could do that, and you know, wasn't necessarily the case. And then I got back into what's wrong with big company, you know, politics and bullshit. And I just didn't sit well with me. And I kind of bounced from big company to big company. I went from Oracle to IBM, you know, and I did a bit of that, and I realized it's actually not the company, you know, like it's me, you know, it's not them, right? And, you know, what is the common denominator? You, right? It's, you know, every yeah. company has its challenges, every company. And no matter where you go, right, they're just going to be different flavors of a challenge, which is normal for big businesses, right? So you can't, if you're going critical, it's more about you than what it is about the company. And I think at that point I went, you know what, well then, you know, do it yourself again, right? Like if you're always going to criticize, they'll go put your own, go put it on the line. And so we did. So started my second business, and that was a Salesforce consultancy with two of my co-founders, and that was Veltio. We built that up. We put some, you know, we put some startup capital in ourselves, just a little bit to get us going. We did a little raise with investors. Did a small acquisition, built the business, and in 3 years we got bought by Blue Wolf. My two co-founders decided to move on and do something different, and I stayed on and did the integration, and really built Blue Wolf in Australia, and that was another really good experience, because one, it was a really good acquisition. You know, when people talk about acquisitions, you usually hear negative things, right? But the Blue Wolf acquisition was awesome. I had a really good CEO who I think I respected as a CEO, you know, and could happily work for, you know. By then, the ego of being the title didn't matter to me. You know, it's like at that point, it's interesting. You chase title your whole career until you get the titles and you realize it means nothing, right? And so working for Eric was great. Working with Blue Wolf was great. The business flourished under the brand. You know, we went, I think when we got acquired, we were about 30 people. By the time I left the business, we were 80, you know. So we just grew quick. And, you know, I at that point, obviously Blue Wolf had a lot of the systems and processes to support that growth, you know. And then they sold to IBM and I went, yeah, no, you know, it's I can't do IBM again. So I actually left IBM to start Veltio. So I wasn't going back.
Get back again.
And I took a deviation into the health sector, and then did it again. I said, oh, I'll start another business in health. And again, totally out of the sector that I've made all my money in. And how hard can it be? Yeah. $2 million later, I figured out how hard it is. Yeah. Blue.
Yeah.
Right. But it was very different this time, right? Like this time it was naivety again, right, to think as an entrepreneur the worst thing you can do is fall in love with your product and your service. Like the worst thing you can do because
– Interesting.
Because in that case, you know, believe so deeply about what it was that we were doing, right? And I learned a therapeutic modality which wasn't approved in the allied health spectrum, right? Wasn't you couldn't tick it, you know, on your Medicare, on your health insurance box. It wasn't physio, it wasn't chiro, you know, it was this other thing. And you know, I didn't realize how important that was, right, in that health sector, because ultimately it meant that patients had to fund themselves. And it wasn't a cheap therapeutic pathway because you spend a lot of time with people. It's very hands-on, right? And the founder of neurophysics, Ken Ware, you know, he was doing like life-changing stuff, especially in the area of spinal cord injury. Like he was doing stuff, man, that I just went, this is God's work, right? And I believed in it so much that I was so blinkeredly committed. I've got to make this work. I've got to make this work. And just good money after bad, right? You know, I had a center in the middle of the city, 500 square meters, $1 million fit out, you know, and was going backwards 30, 40,000 a month, right?
Oof, ouch.
And I did that for 3 years, right? So that was tough. And the worst thing is that you can have such a commercial failure, but such a community impact all at the same time, you know? And that was tough. So closing that down was soul crushing on a number of levels. Honestly, the money didn't give a shit. Like, yeah, blew it, you know, this time didn't have to sell everything, but it was cash. It was all my cash. And I had an investor too. And to this day, that investor is a good friend of mine. And, you know, I'm committed that he gets his money back, even though it was, you know, it's shares. And, you know, when you close business down, you lose it, right? But you know, the hardest thing was pulling down a dream, because that's what it was. It's a dream to help people, and we were doing that.
Yeah,
yeah. And he was driven by the same kind of cause, and even though he was just a silent investor, you know, like I feel obligated to his investment because it came from a good place, right? Mind you, he gave me that money without even signing a contract, right? So, you know. You have a special obligation to people like that. And so,
absolutely.
And so, you know, what was great, but if I want to look for the silver lining in failure, you know, which I like to do, that also changed me. It gave me a whole different perspective of what high performance was, what this human vessel is capable of, right? And a whole new science of systems thinking that I'd never been exposed to before, right? And also, you know, I was an academic, right? And this was deep in the sciences, right? Where it was all academia. It was understanding studies, study design, like, you know, research, right? It was totally alien to anything I've ever done. And that was good. You know, I had to practice a different muscle. So I got a lot out of it. And the best thing that I got out of it was a high performance framework that we developed as part of that journey, which essentially is what I built 8 Squad on, you know. And, you know, and it was also evidence and proof for me personally that you can be going through the worst of the worst situation, but if you know the tools, if you know how, you can pick yourself up very quickly and reassemble yourself, right, without skipping a beat. You know, I was pulling down the center, literally, screwdrivers, stripping out shit, waiting for a defit while I was launching the new brand of 8 Squad, all simultaneous. Like, I had no time to sit back and feel sorry for myself or think or anything. I was going straight out of one into the other. And the mindset, like the pain of failure here, with the wow, let's turn into growth and opportunity here. You know, it's like living in those two states simultaneously. It was a real experience, right? So then, you know, that brought me to 8 Squad and where I am now. And, you know, 4.5 years in, you know, we're now 100 people. We have started from almost essentially scratch. And we've built a leading brand in this market, in that Salesforce ecosystem. And funny enough, you know, like in the same time that I built Veltio, we've built a business 3 times as big as the one we built back then, you know, and without the system and support of what a Blue Wolf brought in, you know, to get to that 100 mark, right? So that's been a whole nother challenge, right? Going through the growth pain of a business, a services business, which is people-centric, and scaling up people and processes at the same time. And also, again, you know, not doing things a conventional way. We put in place a whole governance model that was totally different to any other management governance framework that exists. Yeah, it's not hierarchical or traditional. So, you know, doing that at the same time, right? So it's been interesting. You know, it's been a challenge. We've had our, you know, ups and downs, but I think those two things choosing to go to really lean in on that whole notion of a decentralized autonomous organization as one philosophy, and high performance and high performance framework as a secondary supporting philosophy, those two things together, man, that made all the difference, and I think was a real enabler of us going through this kind of growth. So that's kind of led me to where I am today.
Hey guys, before we dive deeper into this episode, I just wanted to ask a quick question. Are you over worrying about having to create content? Are you over that nagging feeling telling you that you should be posting today, or I should have posted yesterday, or I should be more consistent with my content? Well, there's no need to worry anymore, because my business, Personify, we focus on helping leaders to grow an online presence. And we do this through content creation. We have a multi-step process where we do all of the clip selection, the strategizing, the uploading of the content, the copyright of the content, the video editing, the graphic design, a whole lot across all 10 platforms. So if you're a business owner out there, or if you're a leader, or if you're someone who has something to say and you don't have to worry about creating all this content, which by the way can take upwards of 30 hours each week, then let us know. We're here to help. You can reach out to me on the website, www.getpersonified.com. GetPersonified.co. It's also in the link below. Peace.
That's incredible. And I want to touch on those two things as well. The recurring theme that I hear from my subjective experience being in business, the short amount of time that I have, because the big difference between, you know, working in a startup as an employee, which I've done since 2015, and working in a business, a startup business, and being the person that, you know, if it's fucked, like, you're the one that's fucked, right? And the biggest theme that I've learned from this so far is it's for lack of better words, because I would change the words a bit here and there, but let's keep it quick, would be the market never lies, right? So the results that you're getting, right, there's something there to learn. There's something you're missing or something that you're overlooking, right? If you're someone that's unable to look at what's going on in the business and say, like, where have I fucked up? Or, you know, what am I missing? You eventually come to a point where it just fails. It falls on its own head, right? And I've had so many times, which I'm sure you can relate, like dark nights of the soul, like, what am I doing wrong? Like, am I just a failure? Like, what is this? Like, what am I missing? What is going on here? What is going there? And then, like, you pick yourself back up and, like, you have to pay the bills and then also pay staff and do all these things. So you ask yourself these questions, and then you come upon what the problem was. And then it goes, and then it kind of plateaus. And you're like, oh, okay, there's something missing again. Plateaus. So it's this constant thing. And you become, like, in a weird way, desensitized to the ups and downs. You're like, okay, here we go again. This is a new thing.
Yeah.
And I think from what I can hear, right, and I'm, you know, I'm still young in my entrepreneurial journey, the stage that you're at, you're like, you've gone through so many ups and downs and twists and turns that when it comes to starting 8 Squad, you're like, oh, red flag, green flag, boom, go this way, go that way. And those two systems you mentioned before were implemented much more faster than, you know, starting the building business or the multi-dwelling project that you did, right? So that's the theme that I'm hearing. Is that resonating? Do you think that's true and people should know that?
Yeah, look, you know, you're right. Like, you know, the hardest thing about, and especially young guys starting out, right? I say, look, if you can't handle getting kicked in the teeth, don't even start, right? And if you can't handle that everyone wants a piece of you and it doesn't matter, like, no one cares about you. Like, you're there to serve them. They're not there to serve you, mate, right? You're there to serve them. And if you don't fundamentally get that in your head, yeah, like, you think your employees are there to serve you, you may think again, right? And it's a loveless job. Right? Because whenever they're down, they expect you to be there for them. But when you're down, no one cares, man. Like, because they just take it for granted. You're the boss. So you're all right. And you got to be ready to deal with that. Right? And when it's failure time, yeah, like, it's you. Don't worry about the decisions your people have made. At the end of the day, you reside over it all and you got to figure it out. Right? And inspire your people to help be part of that figuring out, because, you know, the successes are usually all theirs, the failures are all yours, full stop, you know, and you've got to get used to that idea. And I think a lot of young guys do it initially egotistically going, I want to be the king, you know, I want to be the, you know, the big shot entrepreneur. Realize like, hey, there's nothing big about it. Like it's hard. It's a grind. You're going to fail more times than you win. You know, you're, everyone expects a piece of you and no one's got anything to give you back. Right. You know, if you're lucky, you'll find a few good lieutenants and people like, I think it's very hard to find, especially with co-founders, like good partnerships. They're very hard. You know, you've got to understand that. For good reasons, not that people are bad. It's just circumstances change. People change, right?
Yep.
And, you know, if you think going into business for yourself is about being your own boss, think again. Like you're never your own boss. You're either working for your employees because you've got to keep them fed, meet payroll, or you're working for investors if you raise money, right? And the minute you raise money.
Or your clients.
Right, or your clients, right? But the minute you raise money, you're someone's slave, whether you like it or not, right? And so this idea of I want to be my own boss, bullshit. Go do a lifestyle gig. Go open a gym's mowing. Yep, be your own boss. You know what I mean? Like, you know, wake up, don't want to mow lawns today, yes or no? You know, great. But if you're building a real business, mate, no, you're never your own boss. You own the big decisions, absolutely, and you'll be held accountable to those decisions. But yeah, you know, this notion of, you know, being the man and being the boss, it slides away very quick, you know. So it's a good lesson for, you know, for young players coming up.
Is there any lessons that you would share? Like if you were, landscape's different now, time changes everything, right? If you were giving, you know, if you were back, I'm 29, right? If you were my age starting a business now or maybe a few years ago, what would be the, I guess, the wisdom or the knowledge that you would distill to someone who wants to get in the game now?
I don't know if much has changed, to be honest, in terms of how I think about it, right? Know what you're good at and know what you're not good at, right? Like, you got to be real clear on that. Like, be crystal clear on your strengths and your weaknesses and make sure you surround yourself with people who supplement the things that you're not good at and listen to them, right? Like, you got to listen because you're never going to build success, like, on your own. There's always a team, you know? And so having that crystal clarity, you know, like, what do you bring to the table? You know, and don't tell me I'm there to inspire people. Bullshit, mate. You're there to build. You're in the trenches, right? Like, you know, you're not there to just delegate work. So, what is your skill set? Yeah, and how do you deploy it for the business, right? And what are you bad at? And who have you got in your teams that supplements and does that thing for you and holds you accountable, right? And that's really important. Yeah, that's really, really important. And I think, especially if you're in a partnership, often in partnerships, partners aren't clear on what they bring to the table and they all try to bring the same thing, you know, and it doesn't work. It works, and where I've seen really good partnerships flourish, when they were very clear, you know, you're that person, I'm that person, and I'm this person. You know, it's, when you get that right, you know, and I've seen a few, you know, young startups where the founders got it right and, you know, they built, right? So I think if you're going into business, be clear first. You know, don't raise money if you don't have to. You know what I mean? I know there's always conflicting views, you know, the VC industry as well. When money's available, just take it off the table and go, no, like actually don't, you know. If you don't have to, don't do it, right? And you said it before, right? If something's not working, stop resisting and don't believe your own bullshit. Like, I think we can get really caught up in our own, like, ideas, and you got to constantly, like, test your idea. Like, this is my hypothesis, right? How do you prove it? How do you test it? You know, if it ain't working, learn to adapt quick, right? And I think too many people just don't adapt quick enough, you know? And then as you get bigger, systems, right? Like you can't scale a business without systems. And so, you know, regardless of what framework or method you comply to, you need systems in place. And if you're an entrepreneur, if you're like me, you hate the detail like that. And I've had to learn like how to respect that kind of operational detail more, right? And in this business, I've probably learned the most, like because we've grown so quick and we're always outgrowing our systems and, you know, putting in Holacracy as our governing framework, you know, like you've got to be a practitioner, an operational practitioner. So you're going to have to be in the detail. You can't just fly up here. I'm just an ideas guy. I'm just strategy bullshit. Like you've got to be able to come all the way down here and go all the way back up there and be comfortable doing that, even though if it's something you're not necessarily comfortable with, right? For me, definitely not something I was comfortable with, but I had people agitating me all the time, pulling me back. No, come here. You got to understand this, you know? You read this thing called a P&L, mate. Like I'm going to interpret it for you, you know? Oh, fuck, okay, you know? What's that mean, right? And you got to learn that shit, right? You can't just ignore it. You can't just be the ideas guy. That's not going to work, you know? You'd know this very well, right? You've got to, from idea to execution, you know, and everything in between, right? Keeping the business stable, keeping it safe, keeping under having good risk management, you know, all these things that I used to hear and go, oh, what's that? You know, like it's real, you know, and the bigger you get, the more important it becomes.
And I think also for younger people, one of the challenges that they will face, and I'm speaking for myself as well here, is, honestly, it sounds silly, but a short attention span. And what I mean by that is like you need to have the grunt to like pour out the details. If that means creating SOP, like a standard operating procedure, if it means, you know, like overlooking QA process, if it means like creating like one, two, like monotonous manuals on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all the way up to like, you know, 100 steps for a staff member, you need to do that stuff. And if you're like addicted to your phone and you're like, you used to like, oh yeah, like I just saw like a, you know, short video on someone running their business making $2 million in 3 months through trading, whatever. And you're like, I can do the same thing. And you start doing it. You soon realize that there's only so much you can extract from other businesses, meaning like, oh, they do this for the operations. I can do the same. It's like, no,
yeah.
Especially service businesses, as you would know, right? Like me being a service business as well, there's so much room for error,
yep.
Because you're doing people stuff for people. And obviously you can productize some things, but inside that your staff can make so many mistakes and then the end process. And then there's like little things here and there. And for those who don't know, I'm in like doing the content space, which means, you know, little spelling mistakes, American spelling instead of Australian spelling, outsourcing that, quality assurance, step one, quality assurance, step two, the list goes on. So I think a huge thing from me to the people listening is like, you have to be able to learn how to focus. And if you can't, you need to build that skill, because if you don't have it, it will be ripped underneath you. Like you need to have that attention to detail.
You'll fall into chaos very quick if you don't have it. And you're 100% right. And I'm fortunate I had some people in the business who really helped me there, you know, and helped me pay attention and get to that detail. You know, I think the one thing I will say is too many younger people these days don't do enough real work on themselves, right? If you're not a master of yourself, there is no way you're going to master the environment around you, right? And what I mean by that is everything to do with self-mastery, like how you keep yourself in optimum physical condition, because how you are physically is going to determine how you manage stress, yeah? How you keep yourself in optimum mental condition. And what I mean by that is if you truly are a person trying to create a diversity in your employment base, yeah, that means you've got people that you're employing that think differently and act differently to you, right? And if you don't understand how your biases show up and how you filter and interpret these people, all you want is yes people. People who are a mini version of you but not as good, right? And that will say yes to you, right? And that is not the maker of a great entrepreneur, right? And so the more you understand you, like how you communicate, how you receive communication, how you lens, how you like bias when you see someone and their behavior and you automatically default to this when actually it's that, you know? And that level of self-awareness and self-mastery, like if you don't have that, man, you're never going to be a great leader, because you only ever lead the people who fit your leadership style, because they want to be you, right? Really, that's what they want to be you, because often very charismatic entrepreneurs, right? When you look at their organizations, you just see mini-me's, right? You know, when it's interesting, when I see entrepreneurs, I walk into their businesses and I see the diversity of kind of people, then I go, okay, you know, this is a person who really, really understands themselves. And quite often, you know, that tends to be true. Not always, but most of the time, right? Like you can really see that person knows their strengths and weaknesses, and that person has created that diverse culture and has a very different ranging set of people around them advising them, right? And that's when I see entrepreneurs who really succeed and do well, right? Because they really get that themselves. They, you know, they know, okay, look, you know, when I'm talking to an engineer, I know I'm always going to screw it up because I don't hear them the same way. You know, they don't understand me. I don't understand them, yeah. Right? And so, okay, cool. I know I have to be different. All right, I'm going to make an effort to shop differently. I'm going to make an effort just to sit back and understand their point of view. I know when I give them something, they're the kind of people that will never want to give me a response straight away. They want to take it away and think. And they're going to come back to me in 2 days with a very well-articulated, you know, response to the thing, right? And I've got to let them do that, you know. They are, you know, I'm a natural positive person. They're a natural skeptic person. Good doesn't mean they're bad. It means they're there about risk. They're there. They're skeptical. They've got to prove it to themselves. Let them go through the process. Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, and I say this because this happens to me all the time, right? And, you know, what I used to interpret as difficulty in that kind of person, it's not. It's just they hear different. When they hear me talk, they hear, you know, like bullshit, you know, honestly, right? And so they go, oh, hold on, I need to know the detail. Yeah, great vision, but what's underneath that? You know, and that's how they think. And I had to learn that. Right. And people in my direct leadership, I had to totally change how I interact with, because they're worthwhile, you know, and I just had to change how I am. And so if you don't have that degree of self-awareness as an entrepreneur, you're only going to get so far. And so I look at, you know, in our high performance framework, we've got three systems, right? And you have to tick the boxes in each one. In one system, the system of embodiment, right? How do I look after this physical vessel? How do I make sure I eat right, I sleep right, and I train right? Yeah, so that I'm physically up for the stress and I'm physically up to knowing how to deal with stress when it hits me, right? Because often people will do the counterproductive thing. You know, they get stressed, they stop training, they stop meditating, they stop.
Yep.
Yeah. When actually, no, mate, you need to double down on that shit because you don't realize what it does to your thinking and your cognitive skills, right? That's number one. And that the system of belief, this is constantly introspection. And I do recommend to a lot of people, bring coaches. You need coaches, right? Like to help you keep you honest and understand how you show up and understand how you create the dynamics between you and people, right? And so I often recommend, like, you know, we have that internally in our business to do that coaching, right? For managing conflict, right? It's for us, it's a big investment, right? And then system of knowledge, which is constantly assess the things you don't know, like constantly, you know, what's the skill set, what's the domain that you need to know in order to do your job. And if you can't find things that you like, I'm a prolific reader, consumer of content. You know, I'm listening to shit all the time, right? Why? Because I know the more I stick in here, right, the more complex the connections are that I can make to problems. Right. And I can tell you now, like in this iteration of entrepreneurialism, I honestly thought I'd faced most of the challenges I can face, you know, lost a lot of money, been kicked in the ass. I thought, oh man, I've done it all now. Bullshit. Like I've gone through a whole different set of challenges, you know. And okay, cool. What is it in that domain of knowledge that I'm missing? Right. Well, okay, I need to learn how to read a balance sheet and a P&L. Never had to do that before. I had accountants, I had people work. You know what I mean? Sad to say, I never had to do it, right? I knew numbers because I'm a career sales guy. So I understood numbers and, you know, I was great with numbers from a sales perspective, pipeline conversion, all that stuff, had it down pat. But when you start getting into financial operational metrics, I mean, I was out, fish out of water, right? So had to learn, you know. You mentioned standard operating processes and stuff. You know, well, Holacracy is a governance framework, you know, like it's a very
values
governance framework, right? Oh, shit, like you can't just, you know, Holacracy is not something as a boss you go, okay, we're doing Holacracy, but you're all going to do it. I'm just going to keep it. No, you have to be the expert. You have to be the SME. You got to know this shit inside out, you know? And so that was really good, actually, because it gave me a construct to work within. I didn't have to go create it, right? That's the other thing I recommend. Don't go try to create this shit, you know, like go pick a process. You know, there's plenty of operational methods out in market. Go pick one and really understand it, really adopt it. Don't try and mess with it. We did that the first time around with Holacracy. Oh, we like this, but we don't like that. We'll do that differently. No. There's a reason those systems are structured the way they are. They've made all the mistakes. Don't think you're going to all of a sudden be the guru and go, oh, yeah, but we can adopt half of it and not do it. No bullshit. You either adopt it or you don't, right? Pick one, go all in. Don't go half in, right? And that's something I think is also really important, because you don't want to be trying to create those systems and processes or methods, you know. Find one who's proven, done, that resonates with you and how you want to govern and operate your business, and just implement it, you know. So they're the kind of things that I definitely recommend.
So what is a Holacracy. What was the word you used, sorry?
Holacracy,
that's it. Yeah, what's that?
Holacracy is it's a methodology, came out of a company in the US called Holacracy One. And it essentially, it's a decentralized governance model. So it's governance, right? So understand, it doesn't tell you what roles to have, and it just tells, this is how we create roles. This is how we decentralize decision-making. This is the constitution of which how we make decisions. So it gives you all the rules of running a business.
I see.
What you stick into that, it's up to you. How you evolve it, it's up to you. How you implement it, it's up to you. But here are the rules, right? And they're very, like, very defined. How you run a meeting, how you run a tactical meeting, how you run a governance meeting, how you change a governance artifact. Like, all these things are very well described, yeah? And as the CEO, your only decision is one thing. Do you adopt Holacracy or do you not? That is it. Once you adopt it, that's it. You are now held to the same rules as everyone else. So a good example of that is in one of our governance meetings, someone proposed a governance item that I didn't actually agree with as the CEO, which the CEO title does not exist in Holacracy. It doesn't exist. The CEO is a construct, which we make. It's actually not a role, yeah? And so I don't have this title of CEO I can bring to the table. I have roles that I hold that have accountabilities. And unfortunately, the proposal that was being made had nothing to do with any of the roles that I held. So I had no say. And it got adopted. And guess what? It was the right thing. And that's the ultimate test of Holacracy, right? Which is, your personality and your title they don't mean shit, right? And that's what the makeup of a good governance framework is, right? Where personality and title are leveled out, right? Because if you think about it, most companies, 99% of businesses, even some of the biggest businesses in the market today, how do decisions get made? Personality and status, right? The higher up,
yeah,
the bigger the title, and the bigger the personality, like, you know, like you feed in the business, or you've been on a winning streak, and so people are scared. Like, they're the things you often can get through any decision, right? Even if it's the right one or the wrong one, or even if it has anything to do with your domain or not, right? You have influence. In Holacracy, that influence is wiped out. It's a difficult notion for a lot of professional managers who come into businesses to grasp with, because they don't have that title to lean on from an authority perspective, because authority is given to the process. It's given to the constitution, not the person. It's
outsourced.
Yeah.
We have this
idea of role versus soul. So, you know, as a soul, you know, Frank Hewley, I can hold a number of roles. And within those roles, it is defined what is my accountability and responsibility, and that's it. And if a proposal gets put forward, unless it impacts a role that I have, so unless a proposal, let me, what's a good example? I do have a role of setting strategy for the business, right, on where we're headed, yeah? So if someone proposes something that does have an impact on the strategy of the business, then I can object because I have a domain in which I own, I have accountabilities that I can object. But the objection process, like my objection has to be valid. It can't just be, I just don't like it. That's not a valid objection.
Yeah. It feels funny to me.
Yeah, it doesn't feel right. I just don't like that idea. Bullshit. Okay, why? How will it cause harm? If you can't articulate that, you've got no valid objection, right? And so there's still very strict guardrails in which you can object. And it's interesting because you're not objecting to the person or the soul. You're just objecting to the data, right? So that's the other good thing, you know. Tension is a positive force in any adaptive system, right? So let's think about it. When you go to the gym, what do? You create tension in your physical system, right? By lifting weights, by stressing your muscle, stressing being the key operative word, right? Through tension in order to force adaptation, right? Holacracy is the same thing. Holacracy is about surfacing tensions on purpose, looking for them, like actually experiencing, sensing tensions. In my role, because it can only be based on what I'm experiencing, not what someone else is experiencing. That's their business, right? And if I see a tension, I have a forum in which I can raise the tension, describe the tension, and then the process will sort out the tension. And it's very structured. And within that structure, there's such liberation, right? Because I can tell you now, like we look at our holacracy metrics, how many items we process in a tactical meeting, which is more like an operational meeting, and how many governance proposals we get done. And I can tell you now, we're processing machines. Like, we are so much more productive because we've got the data. Like, how many meetings have you been in where you get stuck on one agenda item because everyone's got an opinion and there's no real structure on how to make a decision, right? How many
hours?
Yeah. With us, mate, it's just shut down. If it's, there's no room for discussion. There's a process, and that's it. Follow the process, or the facilitator and secretary of that meeting will shut it down, right? And so that's, yeah, Holacracy's got this really robust framework for running a business. So, and that's the one we do. I mean, again, like there's many out there, and I encourage people to go and explore these management theories and these, you know, these frameworks and methods that can really help you build a business.
Yeah, because you look at like, and again, I mean, I'd say that the systems that we have in government aren't necessarily working as well. I mean, let me take that back, actually. You look at government systems, right, like the founding fathers of America and things like that, they create a system, right? And I think that if it works, it works. But there needs to be a natural, updating system that's still keeping inside the principles of the structure. Go for it.
I hear the undertone of what you're saying. Let's be real, right? Our government systems don't work, right? And
they work better than the alternatives.
Well,
that's what I was trying to say.
Every system has a flaw, right? And democracy has pros and cons, right? You know, there's a lot to be said. When you judge a system, what are you judging it on? Moral judgments or, you know, like actual system judgments, right? You know, but look, certainly holacracy is the ultimate democratic system of governance, ultimate. Honestly, for me, if I look at democracy as a system of government that we all follow, if it was coupled with something like holacracy, I think it'd be a lot better. There'd be definitely a lot less corruption in the system, which we know all exists, right? Even in highly democratic and first world, you know, countries like us, like the US, right? Because holacracy just doesn't allow for any kind of corruption of the system, You know, it's quite unique in that sense. And it's interesting, like, I think all governments should adopt it. Like, it would solve a whole lot of stuff. It certainly would be much more efficient, that's for sure. But you know, yeah, when systems of government are tough, man, like, we vote people in based on popularity, and they really don't have the decision-making capability that you think that they do, you know, like, all right. So, yeah, look, but you know, we're not, I guess we can't solve that problem, but if we can solve it within the context of how we run our own companies, that's a great starting point, you know, because like all good things, like all innovation starts in the entrepreneurial space, right? And it finds its way up into government, into other areas. And I think we as entrepreneurs, that's our, it's our duty, right? To innovate in all aspects of our business, not just the products, but how we run, how we build people, how we invest in people, community, you know, doing good. And hopefully we do a good job. More of us do a good job. That spreads out, and they're your future leaders of government one day, you know, and they'll bring those things, right? And that's what I'm hoping. I'm too old now, you know, I'm done. So I'm looking at the next generations of upcoming talent, and I really hope they, you know, they pick up the ball and keep innovating in how they run companies, which then can move into how we run our communities and our country, right?
So what do you want to see from the next generation?
Man, I think I worry about just this whole political correctness space that we exist in right now. I really do. There's a Stoic, I can't remember whether it was Epictetus or Aurelius who quoted it, but one very, very popular Stoic saying, which is, you know, tough times creates hard men create good times creates weak men create hard times, right? And I think we're going through that cycle. You know, I think we're in good times, and in good times we create weak people. And I use the word men literally. It's just the way it was quoted, right? But you know, it's true, man. And I worry about that. I worry about, you know, we need to harden up a little bit, you know. And I don't mean harden up in that, you know, suck it up, you know, harden up in the old fashioned sense, but we need to become more resilient, right? You only have to look at the mental health stats and you'll realize that there's something wrong, right? Like, I don't have to be subjective about that. I need to be objective about it, right? Like, there's something wrong. More people are breaking down. Why is that? Yeah. There's a lot of reasons. Yeah. In the systems that we exist in, you know, the social media systems, the natural systems, the erosion of nutrition, all these things. Yeah. The bombardment of negative media and fear and all these things, right? Breakdown in relationships, like you name it, right? There's a whole bunch of stuff, right? And I think trauma, you know, like how we deal with trauma, and again, the tools, I just don't know if these next generations have got it right, to be honest. That worries me, because if we're not careful, you know, we'll descend into hard times again, right? And then the generations after that will figure it out, because they'll be forged in steel, you know. But now we've got AI, and AI is another big perturbation in our the systems of being, and that's going to change a lot of shit. And so all these things are happening at the same time. I don't know, man. Like, it's, we need really big thinkers to get us through.
Yeah, I think there's some really cool things happening in the space of awareness around certain topics, like doing trauma work and things like that. For myself, like, I'm on that path now, you know, just from relationships and what I've learned about business and the situations one puts themselves in. And you're like, hang on a second, I've been in the same, it just comes from age, right? Like, I'm only 29, but I can see it already. It's like, hang on a second, I was here 4 years ago in the same fucking spot. Like, why am I here again? And you realize, oh, okay, you know, when I was younger, I was deprived of X, Y, Z, and that made me then recreate that pattern in my own life. And at the same time, acknowledging that, you know, you're not a victim, you're also empowered, hence why you're going to heal your trauma. But I agree with you. And I think the biggest challenge that I face as an individual is learning to decouple from overstimulation, right? That extra dopamine hit of, you know, like, especially if you're creating lots of content online and you're in that business, right? Like you're posting stuff, you're growing, you're like, oh, look at this, look how cool I am, you know? And like, everyone does it, we're all humans. But over time, you learn like things like that matter less. But if I were to leave like one bit of wisdom just from my side, it's that contemplation is the door to freedom. And it's like, we need to, you mentioned things about always having new things in your mind. I think equally, there needs to be an extraction or a decompression process. And there's been studies done to show that when we don't contemplate, we're less compassionate, we're less empathetic, right? And even if those words don't matter too much to you, if it comes to running a business, you need those two things. In fact, I would say that's probably the number one and two skill, or one skill, empathy that you need. So for me, like when I'm working, I'm trying to keep my phone away. I'm not trying, I am. Phone away and then going for a walk, decompressing what's happened after this. After this, I'll just let go. I won't go on Instagram and scroll. I'll go and go for a walk and just decompress, because the mind needs that. And we've lost so much of that. We're just constantly on the hamster wheel of information. So that'll be my two cents, so to speak.
Mate, that's a great practice. And that's worth more than 2 cents, let me tell you. Because I agree with you. Like, you're right. Your brain needs time to just wander, you know, to, like you said, to decompress, to make the connections. You've just taken in a lot of information, you know, like, it's got to find those connections into, you know, all these pathways and go, oh, hold on, I'm going to connect this idea with that idea. And all of a sudden that's inspiration. You've got a new thought, you know. And if you don't give yourself, if you just aimlessly, yeah, jump on Insta and start scrolling, dopamine. Like we have a dopamine stimulation issue in society, you know, like
really, oh yeah, big time.
People's dopamine basal, like their base threshold is just fucking up here. And so unless it stays up here, they feel like, oh, I'm depressed. No, you idiot. You just fucking overstimulated. Like, go on a dopamine detox, right? Like, learn what it's like to sit with nothing for 2 weeks. And it is like you're going crazy. But let me tell you, at the end of that, you're going to see a whole different you, right? And that's the thing, man. Yeah. You know, there's a guy, Jamie Wheel, good friend. And Jamie runs a Flow Genome Project over in the US. And it's very much about high performance flow. You know, Jamie? And he has a great idea, this great concept. It's not his, but it's one he definitely promotes and speaks a lot about, which is hedonic calendaring. And it's a practice I've taken on. It's go, what are your weekly rituals? What are your quarterly rituals, your yearly rituals? And, you know, and this cycle, recognizing that there's like nature, there's cycles. Summer, what you do in summer is different from what you do in winter, different, you know, like, and, you know, part of that is your annual rituals are the big unplugs, the big decompressions, like literally punch out for 2 weeks, no tech, no anything. Like the fasting of technology, you know, and you need that, right? And then you almost need a mini version of that on a quarterly basis, and then on a weekly, but you know, and what are you doing to inspire?
Perspective.
Yeah. Mm. And it's really interesting because most people, you just go through the year and days blend into weeks, blend into months, blend into quarters, right? Like, yep, I just finished this quarter or wrapped up the books. Great. You're already onto the next quarter. You haven't decompressed. You haven't taken stock. You're running, right? Running onto the next. And all of a sudden the year's done. Shit, it's Christmas already. I thought, where'd that go? Yeah, I'm going to run into the new year. And all of a sudden you started again, right? And if you don't have your rituals, and I think, when you look at all the ancient civilizations, they're all steeped in ritualistic practices, right? And there's a reason for that. You know, like there's, you know, I honestly believe the religious ritual of fasting is actually, it's there for a reason. It's got nothing to do with the religious connotation. It's about, you need to starve your body sometimes to let your cells regenerate to do this shit, you know? And they just in to these religious kind of rituals. And yeah, I think definitely, man, like I, it's really good to hear that you do that. I think a lot of people just go into day by day, month by month, you know, and just scroll their way through life, and fucking that's useless.
There's a really cool app called Opal, which it measures when you first open the app, right? It will tell you like, oh, how much, you know, on average, how much time do you think you spend on your phone each day? And of course, everyone puts in a lower amount. And then it gives you a stat at the end. It goes, on average, you'll live for this long based on X, Y, Z. You'll spend this much time on your phone if you continue doing that much time on your phone. So I got this app and then I'm looking at it and it's like, I don't know, something ridiculous, like 20 years or something. I'm like, fuck me, that's crazy. And this app will lock all the, like you choose the apps and it'll lock them from a certain time. The only way you can unlock those apps is if you delete the app. And then when you re-download the app and do all that things, you have to then go through the whole process of doing the whole setup again. So
wow, that's hardcore.
Yeah, yeah. So it's creating friction, right? And you realize you get creative. You're like, oh, well, I'm going to send a message on Instagram for this business thing. It's like, you could find a way, like just figure it out, you know? So that's a huge thing for me. And I think just one point on what you said before there, what was it? I think a common myth is that time spent is time earned, meaning that if you invest, if I do, you know, 20 hours of work straight, then I'm getting 20 hours of work done. But it's like energy is representative of that as well. If I come to this podcast on 2 hours sleep, you know, having Fruit Loops for breakfast with like dairy milk for like, you know, processed pasteurized milk or whatever, you get the point, right? I then come with a different energy. I come with a different feeling. And then sure, you might not feel it straight away, but then what gets put out comes back in a weird way.
Yeah.
And it's one of those, it's hard to put it into science, but I think it's like the law of reciprocity, or the what goes out comes back in, yeah. Something like that.
No, you're 100% right, mate. Like every moment, right, sets in train a set of actions that come back to you. And how you show up to every moment and the quality of how you show up to that moment is setting up for some future, you know. And this is when they talk about the law of attraction, you know, like I don't kind of look at it as in an esoteric manner, like, oh, I put out a thought and the thought will go fine. No, bullshit. No. I have an intention, right? And that intention governs how I show up to every moment. And it's actually how I show up to every moment that sets off energy and then radiates a response from the world, you know, and pulls things towards me based on how I'm meeting every moment, you know. So I totally agree with that.
Or increases the odds.
Correct, you know. So, yeah, so, you know, look, you know, there's a lot to explore, and I'm 51 now, and I'm still learning, and I'm still training, I'm still competing, I'm still like, you know, I pitch myself against 20 somethings and 30 somethings every week just to, you know, to.
You're a black belt, right?
No, well, I've actually gone back and started training in something from the start. So I was a black belt instructor in a number of martial arts, and I picked the one that was most alien to anything I've done. I went to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I started as a beginner, as a white belt. And that's been an amazing journey in its own.
Humbling, huh?
Yeah, very much, very much. Becoming a student, again, a true student, a true beginner. Because anything I've ever done makes no difference when you're on your back. It's just another world, right? The physical demand of BJJ is amazing. I'm probably in better shape now than I've been in 20 years.
How are your joints? Are they they're fine?
Man, oh, you know, look, you're gonna hurt, but that's no different to anything, right? You're gonna hurt. You know, when you
yeah.
compete,
yeah, yeah.
you push yourself at this level, you're gonna hurt. So just do all your recovery stuff. I do my cold baths, do my saunas. You know, I look at my supplements. You know, but pain is. I don't think there's a day I don't go through which I'm not in pain of some kind. You know, BJJ, I've competed again. You know, I'm back. That's just shifted my mental game. It pulls you into the here and now, right? You know, yeah, I definitely am a big advocate of you should do something that has a big cause and effect. You know, it's like some kind of sport that you get immediate feedback if you fuck up. You know, it's like I love climbing.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like, you know, it's such a cause and effect. You slip, you're going to hurt yourself. You know what I mean? And you got to manage the elements there and then. So I love that kind of stuff. And for me, it's martial arts. You know, I came out of last year at, because in BJJ, you stay on the same belt for a long time, right? And I came out of white belt, won the nationals. So now I've been promoted up to blue and competing at blue. And now at blue, you can qualify to go to the world, world masters. And so that's set my sights on that in either next year or the year after. So, you know, man, again, it's, you know, if I know if I'm physically strong, mentally, you know, I'm much better. So yeah, get out there and break yourself. It's great. You've got to put yourself back together.
I love it. And thanks so much for coming to chat with us. Is there anywhere you want people to go to learn more about you or head to 8Squad?
Yeah.
Or would you like to plug, so to speak?
Yeah, thanks, man. You can head to 8Squad. My LinkedIn profile's got a bunch of, you know, articles and stuff. And, you know, I've done a few podcasts and articles about you. Generally everything of my history is pretty much public, you know, good and bad. Always happy to connect with people if they reach out on LinkedIn and quote the podcast. I get a lot of, you know, rubbish connections, you know, of offshores wanting to sell me something. So just tell me you listen to this podcast and I will absolutely accept and happy to connect with people.
Epic. Awesome, Frank. I appreciate it.
Thank you, mate.
Thank you for watching this episode of the Getting Mental podcast. If you like this episode, then you'll love this one here and this one here. Check them out.